On this episode of Skeptico, skeptic James Randi repeats his assertion that all claims of paranormal phenomena that don't pass his million-dollar test are suspect.
Why isn't someone like Sheldrake coming after it? No, he stays away from it because, in my estimation, he knows full well that this business of being stared at and or the dog that knows its owners are coming home, etc., will not pass any test. Now, if it will pass the test, I will give him the $1 million. I will give it to him in the middle of Piccadilly Circus naked.
Stay with us for Skeptico. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and before we get started with what turned out to be a very lively discussion with skeptic James Randi, I want to take a couple minutes and bring you up to date on some things that are happening here at Skeptico. First, I want to talk to you about the experiment that we're replicating over at Open Source Science, the replication of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake's work of dogs that know when their owners are coming home. And you will hear mention of that experiment on the part of James Randi. I'm not sure that he's totally up to date on really where that data or research is, but you'll nevertheless hear his kind of take on it. What I wanted to let you know is there was a little bit of a lull this summer where I really wasn't working on it too much, but I'm back on the trail looking for those dogs, and have been on a couple of radio interviews trying to reach out to dog owners. And I want to reach out to you Skeptico listeners and see if there's anyone out there who is a dog owner and has seen this behavior in their dogs. Or more importantly, if there's anyone out there who's interested in helping me in this effort to find some dogs that know when their owners are coming home. I'd love to get a small group together and try and further that effort. We've had some pretty interesting preliminary results. We've had some great stories of people who have said, yeah, this definitely has happened with our animal or an animal they've had in the past. They've accounted for schedule and things like that. We've even had a couple of people who have gone through and done trials and been pretty careful about it and have come up with some pretty interesting results. It seems to support the idea that, one, this phenomena is probably really happening, and that, two, it's pretty common, as Sheldrake found out when he did a survey of dog and cat owners. So if you're out there and you're interested in getting involved in this way, I'd certainly welcome your help. Email me. You can go to the Skeptico website, and you'll see my email address, and you can drop me a note there. And I think as you listen to this interview, you'll probably come to the same conclusion that I do, and that's that research, like the kind that I've just been talking about, is really the only way we're ever going to know, the only way we're ever going to bridge this gap between skeptics and researchers. So please join me, get involved, let's go after these questions and see where the data leads. Okay, enough about that. Let's go on to my interview with James Randi. We're joined today by someone who's been, without question, the single most influential figure within the modern skepticism movement, and someone, no matter how you might feel about him, you have to admire his many accomplishments in unmasking fraud, deception, and in promoting science and reason. James Randi, thank you very much for joining us on Skeptico.
It's a great pleasure.
You know, before we begin today, I know many of your fans are probably interested in your health. In preparing for this interview, I saw a video that you recently did for the folks at Google. Mm-hmm. And after the initial shock of seeing how much weight you had lost as a result of your surgery, you know, I realized within a couple minutes that you still have that wit and you still seem on top of your game. So I assume you're doing well health-wise?
Oh, yes. As soon as I finish this interview, I'm on my way over to the gym at the local hospital where I work out 3 days a week and find it very satisfying, and it's bringing me back.
Good to hear it. Well, let's start in and talk a little bit about your work, your life's work. Many, many people know that you started out as a magician. I think many folks maybe don't realize what an accomplished magician you were in your time, very, very famous. And I've also heard you tell the story that your interest in skepticism really stemmed from what you saw as charlatans and frauds who were doing the same thing that you were doing, and they were calling it something else. Is that basically how your interest in skepticism was first spawned?
Basically, yes. Even as a little kid, I was always very doubtful of paranormal, religious, and supernatural claims of all kinds. And I soon rather firmed up my belief that these things were probably spurious, but I was always, and I still am always, willing to be shown. As a magician, I was able to see two things very clearly. A, how people can be fooled, and B, how they fool themselves, and the second is far more important than the first. People have a way of deceiving themselves when they don't see answers that they would like, and they prefer those answers. They skew the information they're given willingly in order to arrive at the conclusion they would prefer, whether it's correct or not. And I saw that magicians, all of the magicians, of course, are, but they should be, entertainers, and I certainly was. And I always made it very clear that nothing I was doing, even if I did some mentalism, had any ghost of a chance of being ghostly, so to speak. It was done by perfectly ordinary means that were simply not understood at the time by the observers. That doesn't mean that they didn't have explanations. The explanations were actually quite simple when revealed, or if revealed. And so I knew those two things, how people are fooled and how they fool themselves, and I made sure that I was always very careful to inform my audience that nothing I did had any trace of being anything supernatural or paranormal. And in many cases, I got arguments from people. They'd say, oh, no, you couldn't have done what you just did there on stage without some sort of supernatural help, because that's impossible. No, it only appears to be impossible. When you go to see Star Wars, the movie, you suspend your disbelief, and that's what you're supposed to do when you're being entertained. You suspend your disbelief to the point where you can accept what they're doing, but realize at the same time that when the lights go up in the theater and you leave, you have to step out onto a street that's real and there's traffic there, and you better get that that low tire fixed or it's going to go flat on you. And the mortgage payment, oh, that was supposed to be, I better get that in the mail fast, kind of thing. There is a real world out there, and most people aren't aware of it. But as a magician, I'm very well aware that I step from one world to the other very easily, but I know the line that I'm crossing.
Right. And of course, that's spawned or at least maybe reinvigorated a tremendous skepticism movement that you've been at the center of. And I can't imagine that you would have ever anticipated just what a movement that would what that would become. You know, one thing I wanted to touch on that I haven't heard you talk about, but I have heard many of your followers talk about, is just how that realization or that understanding, or really a belief system in skepticism, has been transformative for a lot of people and has changed a lot of people's lives, maybe because they had a religious or even a cultish kind of background and they've kind of come through that. Would you like to speak to that at all?
Yeah, I the letters that that really make it worthwhile to be in existence, as I happen to be at the moment, you may have noticed, I find that letters that arrive that say, Mr. Randy, at one time I thought you were a terrible person. I got your book, Flim Flam, and I looked through it, or on book on original, or whatever book, and I looked through it. Then I went to your webpage, and by golly, I decided that maybe you are right. I'm going to look into this further. That's all I can ask from anybody, that they take a second look at what their belief system might have been, and they may or may not decide that I have a better grasp on reality than the people who are writing the books that say that the woo-woo stuff is all correct. So that is very rewarding, and I look forward to those letters and notes.
Very good. And those would be probably through your organization, JREF, JREF.org, for those of you who want to visit the website. And through JREF.org, James Roundy Educational Foundation, many, many folks know you through the Million Dollar Challenge, of course, which has become somewhat of your signature venture, if you will. And let's talk about that for a minute, because I had some questions and maybe some problems with that. You know, to me, the Million Dollar Challenge is great for what it is, and that's a way to expose charlatans, fakers, as I've heard you put it, so you think you can fly? Great. There's a window. I mean, I think that's the perfect way to apply that challenge. What I have a problem with, I think, sometimes is that many skeptics I hear apply this million-dollar challenge as some kind of scientific litmus test that science isn't legitimate unless someone has passed the million-dollar challenge. What do you think about
that? Well, claims that people can do, claims by people who say they can do paranormal things or have control of this, that, and the other thing, or know of paranormal powers, can easily, very easily be tested by means of the million-dollar prize. Now, that arose many years ago on a radio program out of New York when I was being interviewed, and one of the, it was a parapsychologist who will remain nameless. He's a good friend of mine, actually, but he's totally out of reality in every respect. But he is an honest man, and he admits that he's never had a positive experiment in parapsychology, which I find very healthy. It means he's doing, in my estimation, that he's doing his research correctly. However, he challenged me, and he said, why don't you put your money where your mouth is? Well, I very rashly, at that point in my career, I believe that was 1968, I said, yeah, okay, I'll give $1,000 to any psychic who can do what they say they can do. Now, in 1968, $1,000 was a lot more money than it is now, of course. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I didn't have any people take me up on it. They all just retreated, and they said, oh, no, it's not a real offer, but I maintained that $1,000 in a special account all the time that I had that offer on hand, and now it's gotten to a point where it's $1 million. Now, it's not my $1 million. It belongs to the James Randi Educational Foundation, the JREF that you referred to, and it is in a special account with Goldman Sachs, and it's invested, and so it makes us about $50,000 or $60,000 a year in income that we can help to run the foundation with. So that's only a very small part of our total budget. But nonetheless, it is there, and it never drops down below $1 million. And its only purpose is to sit there as a huge carrot to tempt these people who say they have the proof. I just got two calls from people this morning who said that they could do this sort of thing, and I simply said, apply. Oh, I don't want to apply. Well, then you don't want the $1 million. Goodbye. We simply ask that they apply.
Well, and I understand that. And again, I think the way the challenge is set up can be a real service to science in that it filters out the frauds and the charlatans or the people who are self-deluded. And the nature of the challenge being that the proof has to be self-evident to me makes a lot of sense. You have to be able to do something, and it has to be self-evident.
Now, what you said there, self-evident, that's the most important point of this whole thing, Alex. The point is that we don't design the test. We design the test only in conjunction with the person who's making the claim. And if we agree, if we both agree on both sides that the test is fair and definitive, that it will prove the case one way or the other, at least under these circumstances for this particular purpose, because it can't disprove a whole claim of telepathy or whatever all over the world. But for this particular instance, it may or may not be successful, and it will demonstrate whether on this occasion, at this time, under these circumstances, this person was able to perform as promised. Now, the fact that they designed the test and that we have a mutual agreement in advance that the test is fair doesn't really work out in practice, because the minute that they fail, whether it's a dowsing test, a telepathy test, a precognition test, a healing test, whatever it might be, the minute that they fail, though they say in advance that everything is copacetic, it's all correct, it should prove my point, they then say, oh, well, it was Thursday. That's not a good day. I shouldn't have worked on Thursday. Thursday is a very bad day for me. Or the moon was in Sagittarius or whatever. They come up with some sort of excuse immediately following their failure, and they never fail to do this. For that reason, I have an envelope with me at all times listing the person's name and giving it to the person who's in charge of the operation, because we don't conduct it. We ask it to be done independently so that we can't have any influence on it. On the result, that is, and I simply give that in advance to the person who's in charge, and after we've finished and they've given their excuses, I ask them to open the envelope, and it says right there, this person agreed in advance not to offer any alibis or excuses, and has just done so. So we're prepared in advance for the possibility that people will offer excuses, and of course they always do.
I don't doubt that for a minute, and one only has to delve into this topic and the controversy surrounding parapsychology and other areas of fringe science to see that goes on. But it goes on both sides too, of course. I mean, skeptics are also quick to sometimes interject pretty unbelievable explanations for research that can't be explained by any other means too. So there's these gaps sometimes, and we should all hesitate to rushing to fill those gaps and should just step back and say, hey, maybe there's more research that needs to be done. And I guess that was my one argument, not with the Randy Challenge, because in the $1 million challenge, I think it serves its purpose very well. I don't like to see it when skeptics apply it as this litmus test where we can say, oh, gee, there's near-death experience research that's going on in some hospital. Well, I'd like to see them pass the $1 million challenge. I don't think that's how it's not a litmus test of whether a topic of investigation is legitimate for science or not.
Well, in most cases, the scientists won't come anywhere near me or the offer anyway, because they say, oh, James Randi is not a scientist. Yeah, but I can tie my own shoes, and I know how to vote. If I can figure out how to operate the machine, I think maybe I should qualify for some sort of consideration. I'm not stupid. I'm not totally bereft of reason. All I do is they say, hey, I know as much as I know under the circumstances that I will describe. I don't claim anything more than that, and I don't claim to be infallible. You are the people who will judge this thing. The answer must, as you mentioned earlier there, it must be self-evident, so we don't have to make any decisions on the thing. You know, if you can fly, you can fly. Step over to the window. Boom. Now I know whether or not you can fly under these circumstances and this particular occasion, etc. So we're very upfront with this thing. And, of course, the big excuse that is offered to us, oh, there's no $1 million. There never was $1 million. Well, it's with Goldman Sachs. All they have to do is communicate by telephone, by fax, telepathy, tarot cards, whatever means they want to communicate with us, and we will send them the documentation. Now, it's been sent out a good half dozen times, I guess, in the past couple of years, and people just say, no, that's a forged document. Well, call Goldman Sachs and find out, because they will happily answer you that that account number is genuine and that there is at least $1 million in the account at all times. But these are the excuses these people give, because they have to have an out. When people say, when the media say particularly, why won't you take the challenge, they don't have an answer. So you look at Sylvia Brown. Her excuse was very upfront. She said, I don't know how to reach James Randi. Duh. You know, she talks to dead people, and I'm very much alive, you may have noticed. And then the phone book, Sylvia, but she said she didn't know how to reach me. Now she says she doesn't want to reach me because I'm not a godly person. Well, wouldn't that be all the more reason to take the $1 million prize?
I think one of the strengths of your message all along has been this common sense approach that you take, and I think it does a great service to science and people who want to kind of turn science into this very complicated, if you could only understand kind of message. And I think your common sense approach has worked throughout your long career in terms of exposing that we can understand this and we can get a grasp on these topics. I do think that comes around the other side of that too, and that sometimes skeptics can take and make things more complicated than they need to be. You know, a couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity to talk with a very nice gentleman named Tom Clark, who just wrote a book on naturalism and runs a website on naturalism, and he's a skeptical guy, obviously. And we went into this whole thing on free will, and I've talked to now several folks on this. And it seems like, again, from a common sense approach, it's such a silly notion. Of course we have free will. Of course I'm deciding the next word that comes out of my mouth. But in the same way that parapsychology researchers can turn things into some kind of complicated mess that doesn't make any sense, I think skeptics can sometimes do that too when they have a belief. For example, free will just isn't consistent with this notion that everything that's going on in our mind is purely a function of our brain. So we have to invent this kind of complicated idea of there being no contracausal free will. Do you have any?
Well, I disagree with that to a considerable extent. After all, we are the product of our training, of our background, of our DNA patterns and whatnot. So a lot of what we decide and what we do is not necessarily free.
It's absolutely.
It's not the kind of thing that we can make a decision on without influences coming into it, after all. We have all kinds of
course.
Things driving us, all kinds of as a background driving us. And can you imagine a Republican saying anything sensible, for example? He probably would be.
But you just withdrew that. Was that your free will to withdraw that, or were you programmed to withdraw that by your all your prior experiences and your mother's weaning you? I mean,
but
the question is, and that's when we get into absolutes. I mean, the position that Tom Clark takes and many scientists take in this area is that there is absolutely no free will at all, that none of the decisions you make are really your own.
Well, they are to a certain extent within a small spectrum of immediate experience, and whether or not you're going to put one foot in front of the other, that is the decision that you make freely. Now, mind you, if a car is coming, you can continue to make that decision freely and get run down, which would not be wise, and something is going to interfere, one would hope, in order to spare you the indignity and the fatal accident. So it's within a certain spectrum. Yes, we have free will within limited circumstances.
I would agree, and I think that's how we experience life. And I think for the most part, again, back to your common sense approach, I think most of the things that we experience and that we see other people experience widely across cultures, across time, I think is a good indication that those are for the most part real phenomena that we can look at. And that would lead me to, I guess, another point where the common sense kind of approach breaks down. And that's that I see some of the research that's been done in near-death experience. Now, I have no idea what goes on with the near-death experience as it's researched in real places, in hospitals, when someone has a cardiac arrest, which is a procedure you were very close to, I'm sure, if you didn't at the time of your surgery, you were in the ward where other people were having that. And as you know, when the heart stops within 11 seconds, the brain is dead. So now we have these people that have these experiences, no matter what we make of them, how we decide. But yet, when we hear skeptics talk, they want to interject all this kind of wild ideas about what could be going on because they're uncomfortable with that gap that we have that we really can't explain how someone could have that experience in that 11 seconds.
Well, no, I wouldn't say we can't explain it. We don't have an explanation.
Good point. I would agree. Right.
Can't be explained. Because I think it can be explained. We know that how the brain relaxes, how the neurons begin to lose their charge and whatnot. And some of it, I underwent a lot of anesthesia when I had my heart bypass. And it was a very serious operation, and I came very close to cashing in. I hallucinated a lot, and I remember those hallucinations very well, but they were hallucinations. I was not asleep in King Tut's tomb while I was under anesthesia, but I believed that I was.
Right.
I thoroughly believed. I hallucinated very strongly that I was. Now, I don't believe that I had anything to do with King Tut. I never knew the man, I swear. I'm old, but I'm not quite that old. The point is that I believed it for the moment because I was hallucinating. That doesn't mean that it's real and that it actually happened. And people don't seem to have much of a good common sense when they start to estimate whether or not something really happens. You go to see a David Copperfield or a Penn and Teller or Lance Burton or any of the great magicians, and you see them do things on that stage which are impossible to do if the representation of everything you see there is correct. And you look at it and you say, well, I saw it with my own eyes. Another statement which is nonsensical. Who else's eyes would you have seen it with? So the fact that you see it yourself with your own sensory apparatus doesn't mean that it's necessarily real, because that apparatus can deceive you. And we magicians know that, and we use the fact that you can be deceived and that you can deceive yourself.
Of course. I think my real point there was that when we have these gaps that we both acknowledge in this case, or I don't know, I don't want to say that you acknowledged it, but we really have no way of explaining in modern neurological terms how this complex brain functioning that goes on during a near-death experience could possibly be happening with a brain that's shutting down, as we said, in that very brief period that we have. So without interjecting anything in there in terms of what's happening, we just have a very big question that doesn't fit into our existing model of how those things work.
Okay, presently.
Right.
Next week, we may have a different explanation for it, and I look forward to that. At one time, we experienced the fact that radioactivity existed. Wow, film sealed up in light-tight envelopes was actually fogged when it was left beside this piece of pitchblende. That's impossible. But no, it was discovered that that the pitchblende does give out the emanations that do pass through this black paper and such, and they fogged the film. Said, wow, what? That's a discovery. Now, that doesn't mean that it's supernatural. It just means, for the moment, it may look to be supernatural. But as soon as we have an explanation for it, we're able to codify it and formulate it, then it leaves it the same way with parapsychology, parapsychological events, if they ever took place, and I've never seen any evidence of them. That doesn't mean they don't take place. I'm really said I've never seen any evidence, and I've looked assiduously over all these years. The minute that they would be recognized, they would not be parapsychological anymore. They would be part of the real world, and we would understand
them. I agree, and you know, that kind of brings up two points that I wanted to talk about in the time that we have, and I realize your time is very limited today. But first of all, it brings up the issue of debunking. And I think I wrote you this in the email. I mean, what the heck is wrong with debunking? I keep hearing so many skeptics, yourself included, saying we're not debunkers, we're not debunkers. Since when did debunking become a curse word? And I think it's a wonderful contribution to say, here is something that's bunk, and I've exposed it.
Well, let me explain what that's all about. If I say I'm a debunker or admit that I'm a debunker, it means that I already have an attitude that says this is not so, and I'm going to prove it to be not so. I can't afford that. All I can say about anything, whether it's a claim of being able to fly or read minds or whatever, is I don't know. I'll find out. So that's investigation. That's not debunking. Debunking means a preconceived attitude and approach,
but
to say this is
not
so.
Really. You know, one of the things I've discovered on this show, and I learned it through an encounter I had with a gentleman I think you know and respect, Dr. Richard Wiseman, and his work with Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, and that's that really there's this collaborative research that folks can do. And there's debunking, but there isn't a lot in between. And this idea of an investigation that isn't a truly collaborative project, I don't think works. You know, so when I talked to Richard Wiseman, and he was nice enough to do this interview, as was Sheldrick, you know, two things come up. First, he reveals that even though he's battled with Sheldrick for 10 years in this raging debate, he now has to admit that, yeah, the data he collected in this experiment does match Sheldrick's. And then secondly, he says, you know, probably the reason why we battled with this so much is that I came in basically as a debunker and he was doing this long-term research. And I don't think he said that. And I didn't take it that it was a slight. It was just the reality of the situation. A media outlet had come in and said, hey, here's this guy who says these dogs know when their owners can come in. Go look at it. And he came in and was looking to kind of debunk that claim. And here's a guy, Richard Wiseman, again, who's done collaborative research with paranormal researchers, so he knows what that's like. I mean, isn't that where we really have to get? I mean, truly collaborative research?
Well, the point is that you can't, at least I can't, afford to approach something with the attitude of the debunker. What I do ends up being debunking, but not until it has been shown not to exist. And in many cases, we can show that the power that the person claims, the ability they claim, does not exist. And we're willing to have them come back any number of times to prove that, or to establish it, or to test it, whatever they want to designate it as. I don't approach the thing as a debunker. I approach it as an investigator. I think it's the attitude with which you approach it that is important.
Maybe it's just a matter of semantics. You know, I did want to, since I just brought up Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, and I was really quite surprised when I did this research to see that you had actually named him, awarded him dubiously with your Pegasus Award last year, and the reason being that you gave that his research, his sample size was too small, and that he had not published that particular research that was in question, both of which I don't think are exactly accurate. But the real question I had is, why? Why someone like Sheldrick? I mean, with all the con artists and mail-order PhDs out there, why pick on a guy that has all the right credentials, has an excellent reputation, has never been called...
He has the credentials, but he doesn't have the ability, Alex. That's the point. He fails grandly when he actually gets around to doing these things. Now, I offered to test the dog, for example. They could tell when people were coming home. I was turned down. I was told, no, you can't come anywhere
Wiseman,
near the dog. Wait a minute.
Wiseman tested the dog.
Yes. But
so I mean, isn't did Wiseman do a poor job of testing the dog? Is that what you're...
No, Wiseman didn't have the $1 million. I offered him $1 million if he'd allow me to test the dog. And he said
but,
no.
But what is that?
And the owners of the dog...
But hold on. Now. I mean, that's back to what we're talking about. That we can't use the... I don't think the $1 million can be used as some litmus test if somebody takes it or doesn't take it. Here you have a very competent guy that we both agree, Richard Wiseman. He's doing a truly... He's a researcher trained in that. Isn't that the situation where we really want, where there's two people who really know what they're doing, who are collaborating, trying to find out the scientific truth? Why would you not be... Why would that not be superior to an experiment?
Oh, it is. It is, admitted. I never denied that. The point is that Sheldrake has now shut me off entirely. He won't respond to anything that I send to him, any inquiries. He won't react to any of it. He has the opportunity to make $1 million if he shows that people being stared at or dogs that know their owners are coming home actually work. That's an open offer.
I understand.
It's right there. The money is on the table, and he has refused to have anything to do with it. Now, there's got to be a good reason for that. He's not required to take the challenge.
There can be a number of reasons for that. I just don't know why you would...
Give me one.
First of all, I can't see how any psychological discovery that we've had in the last 100 years could withstand... The Randy $1 million challenge, because there's...
Of course it could.
Tell me something that's self-evident that's been discovered in psychology in the last 100 years.
Okay. You poke a pin into somebody and they jump. It hurts.
That's not psychology.
Hey, I can test that.
That's not psychology. Tell me. I mean...
physiology, okay.
But so I'm saying, as these... There's other...
Could be something that can't be tested.
Well, I think I turn it around and say, I look at... You know, and I, in preparation for this, I said... Because I thought of that and I go, is that really true? And I looked up a list of the what some people call the greatest accomplishments in psychology in the last 100 years. And you have B.F. Skinner, and you have some of the personality stuff and the memory stuff. And I realize none of this stuff is self-evident. I mean, and that's the real... Again, I think maybe now I'm seeing that you really do think that the $1 million is a litmus test. I mean, I think it's great for someone who thinks they can fly, like you said, but I can see...
I got two choices. I can offer the $1 million or I can not offer the $1 million. I was challenged to offer a prize. I've offered the prize. Why isn't someone like Sheldrake coming after it? No, he stays away from it because, in my estimation, he knows full well that this business of being stared at and or the dog that knows its owners are coming home, etc., will not pass any test. Now, if it will pass the test, I will give him the $1 million. I will give it to him in the middle of Piccadilly Circus naked.
Well, I don't know.
That's a public offer. I will do that.
I don't know if that would...
If Sheldrake succeeds.
I don't know if that would increase the chances or decreases the chances that he would...
But what can I do then?
But hold it.
You know, I'm offering $1 million. No, mind you, not my $1 million. It belongs to the foundation. But I'm offering $1 million and to give it away stark naked. What else do you want me to do? Do you want me to kill my firstborn for him?
No, I don't. The point that I was making, and I mean, you're very, very accomplished guy and have that stage presence and are able to kind of make your points. But the we're kind of dancing around the real issue that I think you agreed with, is that if there's a guy out there like Rupert Sheldrake who does have the credentials and the reputation, no matter what you might think about it, I mean, in a generally kind of common sense accepted way, yeah, he meets the requirements. If he chooses to do his research with Richard Wiseman or with Chris French, another skeptical... Yeah. Researcher in the UK, I don't understand why you wouldn't be cheering that on. Why that isn't the ultimate?
Oh, I cheer it.
Why isn't that the ultimate goal? Why would we pick this guy out as someone who we have to deride? I mean, what we really want, what I really want, is the answer. I want to know the truth, and it seems to me the truth is done by really getting down and doing the research, not by saying, "Oh, we already know it's not true."
Agreed. Agree. That's true. And I'm the clown with the red nose running into the middle of it saying, hey, if you can do that for me, I'll give you $1 million. Toot, toot. But where is Sheldrake? Isn't that... Doesn't there have to be a reason for Sheldrake not... taking us up on this offer? Think about that now.
Yes.
There's got to be a reason that he won't take us up on the offer.
I think we're going over the same ground. I think he can have any number of reasons for not doing that. And as we talked about,
so I'd like to know one.
As I explained, I don't think that the rule of self-evidence really might fit for explaining any kind of phenomena, be them psychological or parapsychology. But
I disagree with that.
I know that's okay that you disagree with that. I think it's unfortunate, you know, when you said the clown running around with the nose. I think it threw clearly to anyone who's looked at your work that you have sought to draw attention to this in a way that for the most part is positive, because it brings science, it brings reason, it brings common sense to the forefront, and it makes people think about it. And we need people who, I don't know if I'd say it the same way in terms of a clown running around with a nose, but we need a little bit of that provocateur. I have a problem when it has a counterproductive end, and that's that it stifles research. And, you know, if we really look at these topics and we look at who's going to decide what research gets done, if we ask the public, they want this research done. Why? I think we need to be more embracing, more encouraging, and more cultivating this kind of research so we can get these real answers, because we're never going to get it if we're just polarized on either side of these controversial subjects.
Well, I think that $1 million is really encouraging. That would encourage me to do wonders. I'd turn handsprings, again, naked in a public place if you want, if I could earn $1 million. That's a big carrot, and it's very encouraging. Now, Wiseman himself could do the research, or Chris French could do the research with Sheldrake, with the $1 million prize being held. It's right there. As soon as you succeed in this experiment, bang, there's the $1 million. So it wouldn't be me doing the test. It would be someone like Chris French or Wiseman or some other scientist with the proper credentials could do this sort of thing. And we always, always have it out of house. We don't do the test ourselves. We always turn it over to a lab or to an association, an organization, a college, whatever, who will do the experimentation, do the whole run on the thing, and announce the results at the end of it. That's the way we have staged the $1 million challenge, and it will always be that way. We will not interfere with it ourselves personally, and if they don't want me to be there, I won't be there. When they did the homeopathy test for the BBC some years ago, they said, we'll keep you informed. I said, no, don't keep me informed, because the homeopaths say that I put out negative vibrations that will interfere with the success of the test. So just don't tell me when the test is taking place. Only call me after the test has taken place. And they did exactly that. And the homeopath failed miserably, dramatically.
Right, right. Well, I tell you what, we are in the process now of looking for dog candidates to repeat that experiment, and we do definitely plan on engaging skeptics as well as believers in that. So I will keep you informed if and when we are ever ready to take the challenge, with the one caveat that we require that the clothes be on when the check is presented. But
well, I've been a year and a half in a negotiation with the homeopaths to do a test in Greece now, and they still haven't come to a conclusion as to where they're going to do it and how they're going to do it. A year and a half of emails and letters being fired back and forth between here and Greece to try to get the homeopaths to get off the button, the stop button that they're sitting on right there. Let's do the tests and let's see what happens with the $1 million. These people are just so slow, they drag and they drag, and I think I know the reason, that they know that the experiment will not succeed and they want to avoid it so they can carry on in the way that they always have, scamming people that what they do is the real thing.
Well, there we have it. There is the voice of James Randi, loud and clear, that we've heard so many years. Thank you very much for your time. I know we said we'd try and keep this to 30 minutes. We've run a little bit over, but I appreciate very much your work, and I appreciate you joining us today. Any last thoughts on things that are maybe coming up at JREF that you want folks to know about?
Look at our webpage, www.randi.org, and it's all there. We keep everybody fully informed. And I'm off to Alaska at the end of the week, and not much for the rest of the year, some lectures and a few things like that, but it's all on our webpage.
Very good. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Randy again for joining me today. He's a very busy guy, as you can imagine, gets a lot of requests for interviews like this. It was great for him to come on the show and great for him to participate in a dialogue like the kind that we have here on Skeptico.com. So thanks for joining us. We have some interesting interviews coming up, so stay with us for that. And in the meantime, be sure to check out the Skeptico website for archives of our old shows and to participate in our forums. And you'll also find there a way to contact me either by email or leaving me a voicemail. So please take advantage of that. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.